This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Today on Intelligence Matters, my co-host Annie McCreadis and I visit the campus of the Texas A&M Bush School in Washington, D.C., where we talk with students about a wide range of issues. Gary Ross, the Director of Intelligence Studies at the school, served as our host. We'll be right back with that discussion after a quick break. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is Intelligence Matters. The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io.
Well, thank you all for coming this evening. I want to welcome Mike Morrell, Professor Annie McCreadis to Texas A&M Bush School of Government and Public Service, DC teaching site. In addition to our classes, one of the things that we really enjoy doing is bringing in subject matter experts to engage in conversations with our students. So we're really excited to have the Intelligence Matters podcast here this evening. And our students are ready with their questions. So Michael, Andy, we'll turn it over to you.
Okay. It's great to be here. It's great to be with you guys. Gary, thank you for the invitation. So we've never done this before, right, what we've done in Intelligence Matters Live. So we're really looking forward to this. What Andy and I thought we would do is just kick it off with some opening remarks, and then we would, you know, dive into your questions and take as many of those as we can possibly take. Andy, why don't you go first?
Great. So I see my class is mostly in attendance here, so that's good. I'm glad you came. Let's see. I guess as we sort of think about things, let me hit maybe on 3 points. And you know, I've spent 38 years in the intelligence community. Michael probably has about the same.
33 years.
And I don't think Michael would disagree with what I'm about to say. Right now, we're looking at maybe some of the most complex world situations that we've probably seen maybe since World War II or before World War II. And so this is a particularly challenging time, you know, not only for U.S. policy, but for the intelligence community. You know, you've got the prevailing challenges with China. There's, you know, the ongoing issues with Russia, Ukraine, and other than the, you know, the potential funding going through Congress now, it's been swept sort of to the back of the newspapers now, or back pages, which is really interesting because that's something I really pay attention to. But of course, we've got the ongoing, you know, the thing that's at the front of the papers is, you know, Israel, Gaza. But there's a lot of other stuff that's going on that I think a lot of people don't necessarily pay attention to. I'm sure that if you asked most Americans, I don't know, 6 months ago, 5 months ago, who are the Houthis? They would probably look at you and go, I don't know. Now, if you ask them today, maybe someone would say the same, but all of a sudden you've got, you know, the small tribal group essentially that is now sort of sitting at a really strategic position and can affect, you know, global shipping. So it's all these variables. And then I think the challenges are is how do they all fit together? And how does one affect another? Sometimes it's not a very direct, you don't see it directly. But beyond those kind of challenges, I think we're facing a really unique time because of the technological advances that are occurring. And, you know, right now, AI is the shiniest tool in that toolbox or others coming that I think could also complicate, you know, the national security environment. AI is the one that everyone is looking at now. And while AI is going to play a huge role for the intelligence community in helping us do the kind of work we do. So, you know, I've told people, and I may have said this to my class, you know, when I was an analyst, you know, you'd get through material and you create searches to help you find material that was coming in. But today, if you use those sort of 20th century methods, you'd be taking sort of a Mount Everest of information and whittling it down to the Rocky Mountains. Still far too much to go through. So you sort of need AI to help you to understand, make sense of all the things that you're seeing, because the data is close to infinite. And so that's where I think, you know, it'll play a big role. But the other, you know, the flip side of that card is that it's an equalizer in many ways, because it's going to be publicly available. People will be able to use it, and our adversaries will be able to use it, and maybe it will give them capabilities they've never had before and challenge us in ways that maybe they, you know, other players who haven't been able to challenge us could. So I think that's a second thing to worry about. And then just lastly, I think tied to that is that, there maybe isn't one antidote to that, but the critical thinking and structured thinking, I think, is as close as we're going to come to be able to sort of pierce that veil of, you know, AI being used for ill, right? There's an intellectual humility that has to happen, especially in the intelligence community. And what I don't mean is being meek, being, you know, being steamrolled, going with the flow. That's not what I'm saying there. It's questioning what you know and why you know it, right? Which we've talked a little bit about in class, but it's a big deal that I think is going to pay huge dividends going forward beyond just sort of the, you know, national security. But it's a skill that I think has been lost, because right now it's about how fast can I get through? What do I click on? Do I read a lot of headlines? And all of a sudden my opinion is formed without really understanding why do I believe what I believe, right? Which is what, you know, good intelligence officers should be doing. What do I believe and why do I believe it? So anyway, with that as a kickoff, Michael.
I too have 3 points. The first is, you know, I agree 100% with Andy about the complexity of our times. I think Bob Gates, in a recent foreign affairs article, said this is the most challenging, complex time since World War II. So it's a good person to be aligned with. But I want to take it in a little bit different direction than Andy took it. Because the world is so challenging and complex, I can't think of a better time than to study international affairs and to study intelligence. I mean, if I were your age, this is where I would be, right here, because this is so exciting, and so much is happening, and it's so challenging, and it's so important to the future of the world, the future of our country in it, our well-being, our national security, right, all sorts of things. So you are in exactly the right place at this moment. My second point is I want you to think about the place you end up at when you're done here, right? And I want you to really think about, you know, I know some of you are already there, but I want you to really think about a career in the intelligence community. The 33 years I spent there, the best years of my life, I miss it every day. There was not a single day, and my wife were here, she would say, he's telling you the truth. It's not a single day I didn't want to go to work. I looked forward to Mondays, not Fridays. You know, the work is meaningful in terms of protecting the country's national security. It is impactful. You are given responsibility on day one. You know, most places you go to work, you're for a long time, you are not in the batter's box, right? In the intelligence community, you are from day one. You know, you're responsible for issue X, Y, or Z, and if the president wants to know something about that, you know, you're up. Meaningful, impactful. They invest a tremendous amount in you. They did that for me when I was the head of analysis. You know, every 6 months I would approve, you know, 100, 150 people to go off to full-time language training, full-time graduate school. You know, we really care about investing in people, and so really think about it. And as you think about that, I want you to think about the difference between trucks and terrorism. Now you're all looking at me like, what is he talking about? When you go home at night from a job, do you want to go home and tell your family that you sold more trucks than any other company in the United States? Or do you want to go home and tell your family that you worked with a group of people that stopped a terrorist attack against the United States?
That's the choice you have. That's how impactful it can be. Third point is people ask me all the time about, you know, how do you get ahead? I'm sure you get asked the same thing. So I wanted to kind of jumpstart, right, that question, beat you to the punch on that question. We actually did a study, you might remember this, we did a study at CIA in the analytics side of CIA about, you know, what determines somebody getting to a senior level. And, you know, we looked at, does it matter what school you went to? Does it matter what your grade point average was? Does it matter whether you had a BA, MA, or PhD? Does it matter, you know, what account you're working on? So we looked at everything, and there was no correlation with any of that. And when you dug into it, the reality was it came down to three things. It came down to a strong work ethic, like working really hard. It came down to being open to learning. Right? You get a ton of feedback every day. Are you open to learning in the reception of that feedback, you know, or do you reject it? The third is being effective operating in a team environment. Right? There's no such thing as, you know, a single person doing a single job. Everything's teamwork, and so you've got to be able to work with a team. Strong work ethic, open to learning, and being an effective team member. Those three things will determine success not only at CIA, not only in the intelligence community. Quite frankly, it'll determine success anywhere. Okay, let's open it up to questions.
So thank you for joining us again. And I think I will take Professor's prerogative and toss the first question up to you, and then I'll give the rest of the students an opportunity to formulate their questions. In our courses, you know, we try to make sure the students understand that, you know, as members of the intelligence community, you are apolitical and you should not be involved in the formation of policy. We leave that to the politicians. I think one of the trends that we've been seeing now is that people who leave the intelligence community, it seems, perhaps appear a little bit more free to, now that they're outside the intelligence community, become more political and to weigh in on some political topics. So I was wondering what your thoughts were on this perhaps trend for former intelligence community officials.
It's a great question. You can ask the same question of military officers, right? Former military officers. You know, when I left in 2013, I had no intention of getting involved in politics, and yet I did. You know, I endorsed Hillary Clinton in 2016, and then I was involved with the infamous Hunter Biden laptop in 2020. I did those things because I thought they were in the best interest of the country. And what I found, right, was a significant backlash. Backlash against, you know, what I was saying, backlash against the idea of former intelligence officers being involved in politics, a twisting of what was said. In the Hillary endorsement, I called President Trump a unwitting asset of the Russian Federation. And people have conveniently gotten rid of witting and said I called him a Russian asset. And they said that wasn't true. So you lied. And the Hunter Biden thing, they said that we said it was disinformation. We never said that. Politico said that. Vice President Biden said that in the debates. We never said that, but people said we said that. They said we lied. The truth is, that's what we actually thought, you know, what we said, which was what we're suspicious about the Russian involvement here. So the whole thing gets twisted, right? And it gets into this political world that is actually a very tough world to play in, right? You actually have to have skills to play in this political world, and it's not something we ever learned. Right, so you enter this political world, and man, it's a challenge. You can, you know, having said all of that, you can legitimately have a debate about whether former military officers, former intelligence officers, should be involved in this world. And I have it with myself all the time. I really do. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I had second thoughts or what have you. But I ask myself that all the time, and I ask myself that all the time because I think it had downsides for the intelligence community and for CIA. You know, people saw me being political, and I think people thought, I wonder if the institution itself of the intelligence community and the institution itself of the CIA is also political. And I think that's the strongest argument for not doing it. Last thing I'll say is, you know, I spent some quality time with the House Judiciary Committee talking about the Hunter Biden letter, and I told them that I was never going to get involved in politics again.
I think that last point that Michael made is a really important one, or one of the important ones, and that's the people begin to, you know, in your private life, you can get involved in whatever you want, right? You have the freedom to do that.
First Amendment.
Yeah, but people then question, when did you become political? Were you political when you were in the job? Right, and then they begin to make all these connections that Michael suggested, and therefore it's not just you; you're sort of pulling the organization with you, especially if you left at a senior level and if you didn't leave too long ago, it comes with you, and that's a real challenge.
You know, it's really interesting to look at this from President Trump's perspective. You know, one of the things you learn in the intelligence community is that your job, right, your fundamental job is to see the world the way the other guy sees it, right? Is to understand how Vladimir Putin sees Ukraine, is to understand how Kim Jong-un sees North Korea and sees the United States as it relates to his country, right? It's really important to put yourself in the other guy's perspective. And if you think about what President Trump was seeing in the 2016 election campaign, he was seeing, you know, a former deputy DNI, former director of NSA, former director of CIA, Mike Hayden, really kind of go after him day after day after day on CNN. He saw John Brennan as the sitting director of CIA say at a Harvard conference that if President Trump follows through by walking away from the Iran nuclear agreement, that would be utter folly. And he sees a former acting director of CIA and former deputy director of CIA endorsing his opponent. So what's he supposed to conclude from that, right? What's going on with these intelligence guys, right? Is the intelligence community of CIA just as political as they are? Right? It's really important to get inside the other guy's perspective. It's a really great question.
I'm sure we have some even more great questions from our students, so I will hand it off.
So how do you blur the line when you're looking at politics and how it affects the future? So for example, we're seeing a lot this week about President Trump saying that if he was to become president again, he would kind of withdraw a lot of U.S. support from NATO and how that would affect the Russia-Ukraine situation. And when you're looking at it from a foresight point of view and what the future looks like in that conflict, how do you kind of make sure that you're not crossing the line of getting into politicization, but emphasizing what that could look like in the future?
In terms of politics here, right, that's not something the intelligence community assesses, but we do assess how the rest of the world looks at our politics. So how is the rest of the world reacting, you know, to what the former president said? How is the rest of the world thinking about the choices that are going to be made here and about the outcomes that will happen based on them? That's totally legitimate, you know, fertile ground.
Moving on to our next student.
Howdy. Thank you guys for coming. I really appreciate it. My question was, it sort of deals with presidents. Recently, we saw in the news, like, President Biden was recently, I don't want to say let off, but he wasn't found guilty of mishandling documents. And then you also had President Trump, you know, at Mar-a-Lago having classified documents. And it seems like there's a lot of senior officials that have all of these documents and are mishandling it. What are you guys' opinion on it, and how do you think that these documents just keep getting mishandled?
This is actually something I feel strongly about, right? Because we, in our careers, you know, there was an extraordinarily high expectation that we would properly handle classified information. And obviously, you know, what we're trying to protect is the information of the intelligence community, and what we're trying to protect there is the way that we collect it. You know, we call it sources and methods. You know, if you if you give away information, then you possibly, you know, tell the adversary how you got it, right? And then they could stop you from getting it. So it's extraordinarily important to protect this stuff. And there does seem to be, right, kind of a flurry of former senior officials who, you know, for whatever reason are not properly handling classified information. Anybody who mishandles it, you know, needs to be held to account. But in particular, senior officials who mishandle it need to be held to account, because you can't send a signal to a new officer, a young officer, somebody who's just entered on duty, that if the senior doesn't have to handle it properly, why do you expect that of me? Right? So the standard has to be the highest for the most senior officials. And that includes presidents. That includes presidents, right? You know, I was thinking the other day with both President Trump and President Biden, how would I explain to a brand new CIA officer, you know, why they need to carefully manage classified information when our seniors, our country's most senior leaders, have not? And I think that's a really important question to ask. You know, just because the Justice Department declined prosecution does not mean you haven't done anything wrong. You know, we had tons of cases at CIA where somebody makes a mistake, somebody does something wrong, you refer to the Justice Department to see if they want to take any action, and 9 times out of 10, they come back and they say no. They don't tell you why, but they come back and say no, and usually it falls into one or two categories if they could actually tell you. You know, one category is we can't make a case. Same thing that Mr. Hirsch said about President Biden. And then the other is, we don't think this is that significant, right? One of those two reasons, they decline. But when they decline, CIA just doesn't go on with its life. It actually does its own investigation into what the person did and makes a decision on whether they take administrative action. So we might have a person who mishandles classified information, and the Department of Justice says, we're not gonna do anything with this, over to you guys, and we investigate, and we make a decision to fire that person. We make a decision to do some sort of sanction. Maybe they can't get promoted for, you know, 5 years. You know, we make a decision to sanction them even though the Department of Justice has not. You can't do that with presidents, right? They don't have a boss. So when it comes down to them, they sometimes have to hold themselves accountable, right? And for me, that means standing up and saying, I made a mistake, put the country at risk, shouldn't have happened, it's never gonna happen again, I'm very, very sorry, right? So I think this is just so extraordinarily important because, you know, we've gone from Hillary Clinton to President Trump to Vice President Pence to President Biden, right? I mean, there's just so much of this out there. And we simply can't have a system in which some people mishandle classified information and are not held accountable for it. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of our discussion at the Bush School.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
I think there's also one other piece to this, and that's the government has a problem with classifying far too much. And so you've got the problem that Michael described, but then you've got sort of this huge quantity of information that gets classified, and not all of it really requires classification. So you magnify the issue by everything is classified in some way, shape, or form. So that I think, you know, the government needs to take a hard look at, you know, the criteria for classification. What level do they classify things? Because it's enormous.
I don't know if either of you want to add about international alliances and working with our partners who may have some information that's contained in some documents and how this might impact our relationships with some of our closest allies?
Yeah, I think, you know, it makes them question whether they should be sharing information with us. I know of CIA operations officers who have had conversations with their assets. You know, when something leaks and something gets out into the public domain, whether it's authorized or unauthorized, there's plenty of CIA sources who wonder whether their information might get out someday and have raised that with their CIA operations officers and say, hey, are you guys going to protect my information? It might affect potential sources, right, who are thinking about working for the U.S. And maybe they think, you know, maybe they give that a second thought when they see information being leaked. So it's extraordinarily important. You know, I just add to Andy's point, obviously I'm passionate about this. I just want to add to Andy's point, right? A lot of these things are institutional problems. So many people leaving jobs at the White House and being able to carry out classified information, that's an institutional problem, right? You shouldn't be able to do that. Every box should be searched that you're taking out of the White House, you're taking out of the old executive office building, right? Somebody needs to look at that box and say, you know, stamp on there, no classified information in here, and then seal it shut. That's an institutional problem. Secretary Clinton's problems at the State Department were actually an institutional problem because State Department officers have, for a very, very long time, put classified information on their unclassified system. You know, and in Secretary Clinton's case, even if she didn't have a private server, right, that classified information would have still shown up on State Department's unclassified system, which was just as vulnerable as her private server. So these are all institutional problems.
So, you know, I just left a year ago. I took a bunch of, 38 years, that's a lot of boxes of stuff that you accumulate. I must have gone through each box like three times. So it is a bit of a process to go through, especially over a long period of time or in a very busy place where you're accumulating a lot of stuff. But Michael's right. There's really no excuse to, you know, find that stuff at home.
I think we have a couple other student questions here. I'll work my way around.
Great. Thank you very much for being here tonight. You talked about AI as a potential tool for the intelligence community, and it feels like more broadly, AI has suddenly, in the last couple of years, become relevant as a tool of national power, which means that there are all these new potential organizations like AI labs that I would guess traditionally weren't intelligence targets. How is or should the intelligence community be reacting to suddenly these new groups becoming very relevant?
Well, look, you know, just like any new, you know, technology, whether it's specific to a, you know, a weapon or not, anything that poses a direct challenge to U.S. national security, it, you know, becomes an intelligence topic of interest, right? You're going to want to know how far along an adversary is on their AI development. But, you know, another piece of this is that it may not just be the AI development. It's a tool used in two different ways. And so it's not only just the AI development. It's like, you know, what's the use? How can this be used? And understanding what the use cases are, you know, so that you can then figure out how do I defend myself? Because ultimately, it's going to be, you know, it's sort of AI versus AI, right? AI offense versus AI defense is the way that I can't really see this playing out in any other way other than that. And so you need to understand the capabilities, right? So, you know, the executive order, you know, that came out about AI, you saw a bunch of the big AI, you know, companies that have the large language models, you know, all made a promise, or I guess you can call it a promise, to the White House that they would make sure that AI wasn't used for, you know, bad things. Chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear was one of the things that was specifically called out there. Okay, that's a big promise to make. And it's not a one and done kind of fix. You know, you might be able to say, well, we put guide rails on it. Is tomorrow's version going to be better, way better? And so those guide rails may no longer work. And so there's this process that we've now kicked off where there's going to be the constant vigilance is going to be required. Some countries aren't going to do that, right? And so it's almost a proliferation problem, like we used to deal with, you know, WMD proliferation. This is sort of beginning to potentially look like that.
All right, move on to our next student.
Thank you guys for both being here and taking the time. Earlier, before Russia invaded Ukraine, we saw the Biden administration start to you know, start to marshal out or, excuse me, send out signals that Russia was serious about invading when a lot of people figured they probably weren't. And you saw some sort of, deterrence mechanism to try to get people to take it a little more seriously. And I was curious kind of, you know, what might have gone through their mind to choose to release that information to show the general public that this was serious and this was happening. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
You know, the Biden administration calls these strategic downgrades. Some people think that this is kind of new. It's actually not. People have been doing intelligence disclosures, you know, for a very long time. You know, think about the Kennedy administration deciding to show U-2 photos, about missiles in Cuba. What's new with the disclosures is previous disclosures were one and done. These are continuing, right? They continued during the entire run up to the Russian invasion. They've continued since. They've now been expanded to China issues. So they're being used more and more. And obviously people think they're effective, right? Or they wouldn't be doing this. By the way, this is not an intelligence community decision. This is a policy decision, right? To release this stuff. There's downsides to it. And I think most people think about the risks to sources and methods, but I actually don't worry about that very much because I think the intelligence community is pretty good at managing that risk, at mitigating that risk. And I'm sure the intelligence community would not release something that actually put sources and methods at risk. What I worry about in this new world we live on in terms of strategic downgrades is politicization. It gets really easy when you start releasing things, not for the intelligence community, but for policymakers to start spinning it, right? To changing the emphasis a little bit, right? To make their point. We saw that with the Iraq War. President Johnson did it with regard to the Gulf of Tonkin. He released some stuff. And they spun it a certain way, and the way they spun it was completely wrong. So there's actually a history to politicization here, too, with regard to intelligence disclosures. So I think, you know, this is going to continue. This is like a genie out of the bottle now. Policymakers are going to use it over and over again across multiple administrations. And what senior intelligence officers are going to have to focus on is making sure that it doesn't get politicized.
So I'm going to take one more professor prerogative. Here at the Bush School, we're preparing the next generation of IC professionals and IC leaders. And so I'd like to take the opportunity to see if you guys could offer up some advice to people either beginning their careers in the intelligence community or your advice for people who would like to pursue careers in the intelligence community.
Okay. People who are beginning their careers in the intelligence community, I really do think that, being intellectually curious, being willing to take chances on, you know, jobs, raising your hand for jobs that people say, I would never take that job. You know, sort of putting yourself in those positions where you accumulate knowledge makes you, you know, better as an IC officer. I think if you were to pick any group of senior intelligence officers who have risen through the ranks and you wrote down what they did, you probably wouldn't hit too many matches, even though I did follow Michael in several jobs. You know, everyone's taken a bit of a different path. And so, you know, what that says to me when I look at that is that there isn't no, you know, one way, to get to a more senior level. But there is something in common, and that's, you know, people have a variety of experiences. And some people are open to that. Others are afraid to do it. And I think to become the kind of intelligence officer that we need today to face the kinds of challenges that we talked about, you need to be willing to do that. And sometimes that means it's a bit of a side rail on your career for a couple of years. And it's sort of like investing, right? You know, you can invest for the short term, but you can also invest for the long term. And sometimes those jobs are like long-term investments that then pay back way later that you hadn't anticipated.
In terms of getting there, getting to a job, I'd say a couple of things. One is, you know, really concentrate on making yourself competitive. So on the analytic side, right, They're looking for critical thinking skills. They are looking for written and oral communication skills. And they are looking for intellectual curiosity. You know, what does that mean? Are you the kind of person who's just satisfied with a surface understanding of a problem? Or do you want to understand a problem in all of its depth and all of its complexity? Obviously, you know what they're looking for. That's intellectual curiosity. On the operations side, right, they're looking for incredibly strong interpersonal skills, incredibly strong emotional intelligence skills. You know, what's emotional intelligence? It's you and I are having a conversation, and I know exactly what you're thinking and what you're feeling based on your body language, based on the tone of your voice, you know, based on your facial expressions. Right? I just feel it. And then the third thing that they look for is, it's going to sound weird, but they look for, you know, self-confidence. And you say, what does that got to do with it? You know, the hardest conversation you can ever have is sitting across the table from another human being and trying to convince them to commit espionage against their own country. And if you don't have a ton of self-confidence, you're not going to go anywhere near that conversation. So they hire for self-confidence. So, you know, build your resume accordingly, right? Time overseas, language skills, interest in a particular part of the world, right? Those are all important things too, but those three things that I gave for each, critically, critically important. And look, a lot of people apply. A lot of people apply. I don't know what the latest data is. You know, the last I heard it was 80,000 applications a year. But a lot of people apply for only a few positions. A lot more people are capable of working there than they have jobs. A lot of people apply multiple times. A lot of people who work there have applied multiple times. So don't give up, right? The more persistent you are, the better, actually. It shows you're passionate about working there.
I think this is my opportunity to plug the Bush School once again, because we certainly have placed several of our graduates, both from College Station and here in D.C., into the intelligence community. I think I have another question here from a student.
Hi, gentlemen. Brady Bialik, MIP student here. Thanks for your time. My question is about China. The national security strategy lists China as our singular pacing threat, yet increasingly we see our resources and attention being drawn to conflicts in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, as you alluded to, Professor. So my question is the United States national security community and intelligence community making the necessary pivot to face this challenge? And if not, what do you see as things that we need to work on now to do that? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I don't like the word pivot. And I know you're just using it because everyone else is, you know, talking about pivot. But that sort of suggests I'm facing one way and now I'm going to look in another direction. We can't afford to do that, right? And people have talked about, well, the pivot away from terrorism to, we should not be pivoting away from terrorism. We might have to think about how do we allocate the limited amount of resources we can across all the threats. New tasks are levied at a pretty regular basis. Nothing gets really removed. So, you know, you're in this situation where, you know, you've got to place some bets. But it's part of the intelligence community needs to be nimble.
Let me say two things about China. One is, you know, 15, 20 years ago, anybody who watched China was of the view that as they got richer, they would become more liberal, small L, right? And we were wrong about that. We were absolutely wrong. And when you go back and think through why we were wrong, you know, what you see is that we saw the dynamics in Chinese society that were pushing in that direction. But what we got, what we missed was that the Chinese leadership would have a vote in that. And lo and behold, Xi comes to power and says, I don't like those pressures. Right? Those pressures put me at risk politically and put the Communist Party at risk politically, so we're not going down that road. And took China in another direction. So we were wrong about that fundamental judgment. Today, we are all, and I put myself in this group, right? We all see the challenges, the threats that China poses to us. What makes us think we're right today? And so I think it's one of the responsibilities of the intelligence community It's one of the responsibilities of the intelligence community is to challenge that thinking, right? Is to say, what if we're wrong? Right? We didn't ask that question about Iraq WMD. What if we're wrong? How could we be wrong? And I think that's required on the China issue because it's become such a mantra. It's become such a, it's the only issue in Washington that everybody agrees on, that China's bad. Well, let's make sure that we actually have that right before we go down the road of going into a Cold War with this country. So that's thought number one. Thought number two is I have no idea how the intelligence community is doing on China. I don't see intelligence. I don't get briefings. I don't ask for them. So I have no idea. So this is Michael speculating. He probably knows more than I do, and he can't talk. But my guess, to answer your question, is we're pretty good at understanding Chinese capabilities, particularly on the military front. Because it's kind of easy to understand the capabilities of another country. Because a lot of it's technical collection. You look at the capabilities of a military jet and you can kind of figure it out. What's really hard is intentions, particularly political tensions, political intentions. That requires, in most cases, a human source, you know, right up against the right people. I bet you we're struggling with that. And that's a problem. Because when you don't have hard intelligence on intentions, analysts fill the gap with their assessment. And it's very easy to go wrong because a lot of biases start coming in. You know, I think one of the things that happened in Gaza is the Israelis had a decent idea about Hamas's capabilities. They had no collection on intentions, and the analysts filled it in the wrong way. So I bet you, you know, that's how we're doing. So we have a lot of work to do, I think. I'm gonna make one more point.
Once you get into this, right?
Get into this stuff, you have a hard time stopping. We are taking resources away from terrorism. And terrorism is going to come back. First of all, it's in general cyclical, right? If you have the right intelligence, you have the right military capability, it's pretty easy to degrade a terrorist group. When you take that pressure off of them, they bounce back very quickly. So it's by its nature cyclical. Layer on top of that Gaza, right? And terrorism is coming back. It is absolutely coming back. There's a whole new generation of terrorists who are going to be created by what's happening in Gaza. The Al-Qaeda regional nodes, the ISIS regional nodes are undoubtedly trying to figure out how they take advantage of this. The lone wolves around the world are already attacking targets in Europe. It's going to happen here. So I worry about the decline in resources on terrorism.
I want to thank both Mike Morrell and Andy McCreadis for coming and joining us for this academic exchange with our students here at Bush School, D.C. Certainly, you guys are welcome back anytime. This is a great opportunity for the students to hear from senior officials, former senior officials. We'd love to do it again. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Great to be with everybody.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming.
That was Andy and my discussion at the Bush School, D.C. Please rate and review the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.